taking tonight from that prime yoga text, Bhagavad Gita, which, without a doubt, is the most comprehensive handbook for making the human form of life successful. Now, I wonder how many of you have thought about what constitutes a successful life. None of you, I'm sure, wants to be a failure, right? You want to feel that your life has some value. So how is it that your life should be evaluated? This is a good point for us to think about. But consider, please, that evaluating your life could very well depend on criteria beyond your own making. And this may feel a little uncomfortable for us. My life should be evaluated by me according to my standards. Some or other, we have this notion that we should be the lawmaker, the judge, the jury, and the hangman for our own life. After all, it's my life. Who can decide for me what I should do? Who can decide for me what is good, what is bad? All that should be totally under my control. Now let's consider your whole lifespan. We were speaking a few days ago about regrets. Certainly there'll come a time when everyone in this room will leave aside the present body. Now, how would you feel when you're about to give up your body? Or let's say you've been given notice that you have a month or two or three to live before nature reclaims your body through terminal illness. What would be your internal state? What would be going through your mind? Persons who work in hospices dealing with terminally ill patients, they say that, first of all, when you get the news, you go to the doctor, he does a checkup, calls you into his office, and then he clears his throat. You know something is up. And so you're informed that, indeed, this body has an end. Hard though that may be to believe, my body is coming to an end? How can that be? That happens to everyone else. Don't think that just because you're very old that you'll easily let go of the body. Even you may be in pain, such pain that you think, I don't want to live another day. But when it actually comes the moment to give up your body, all your attachments just jump you. All the attachments that you have throughout your life, they don't just suddenly disappear. They pounce upon you at the moment of your leaving the body. Because what you really want to leave is not the body, but you want to leave the pain of the body behind. So actually, simply having pain doesn't cause you to be detached from having a body. So even if you're very old, you still don't want to give up the body. You simply want to give up the pain. And of course, if you're very young, or even moderately young, or even in your middle ages, how can you give up the body? You have so many plans to execute, so many missions to accomplish, so many desires to fulfill. Because we have those desires, those missions, those plans, we feel like nature owes us a long lifespan. It just has to be like that because, you know, I have things to do. I have things I need to accomplish. And we also feel that in our own way, we're a good person. And, you know, how can nature put an end to the body of a good person? It does happen, unfortunately, sometimes, but not to us. You have horrible events like what just happened in Connecticut. But everyone knows that would not happen to me because I'm basically a good person, we think, about ourselves. We think that we may not be the best person, but we're not the worst, right? We're not saints, but then again, we're not the worst sinners. So the world owes us opportunity. Can you see how you're feeling like that? I mean, I'm here. I'm alive. I've got things to do, places to go, people to meet. Surely the world will allow me to fulfill at least 90% of my visions. I don't expect perfection. I'm modest. I'm humble. I don't expect 100%. I'm realistic. But 90%, that would be acceptable. So we all have that feeling that the world owes me something. Remember when you're a teenager, you felt that the world owed you a wonderful, passionate teenage romance. Why? Because you're a teenager. It's got to happen. And then maybe if you, later in your life, you graduated from university, and what do you feel the world owes you? The world owes you not simply money, but a fulfilling job, a satisfying job. It's got to be there, because after all, I went to college. So where is the fulfilling career that is meaningful? And, of course, where's the money? And then, as the years proceed, you feel that the world owes you the dream partner, the dream relationship, because the hormones in your body are demanding things, and so you think that those things must be fulfilled because I'm feeling for these things. Since I am feeling for these things, there should be fulfillment of the desires that I'm feeling. So I've explained this several times. We take two separate things and we merge them together into one singularity. On the one hand, over here, we have desire. And on the other hand, over there, we have fulfillment of the desire. But we think, because I'm desiring, the desires must be fulfilled. In other words, we take two separate things and merge them together. Desire, fulfillment of desire, it's all one package. I'm feeling desire, so that means fulfillment. It's just a matter of time. I just have to work harder. Meet the right people, have a bit of luck, and surely at least 90% of my desires will be fulfilled. Isn't that generally how we feel? And then you reach a ripe old age in your 70s. You realize then that 90% of your desires haven't been fulfilled. But then, what's the next step? Huh? My children will fulfill all their desires, and then I'll be happy. So you pass the whole scene on to your children. You be happy, my dear beloveds, and your mother and father will be happy watching you be happy, watching you be successful. It's like, you know, an Olympic event where they have the relay races. So one runner runs for a certain leg of the race, certain distance, with a baton, you know, and then passes the baton to the next runner. So we do like that. We pass the baton of material existence from generation to generation. All right, I couldn't complete the race. I couldn't fulfill my desires, but you can. You try harder, my dear child. In this way, the false pursuit of material fulfillment is passed from generation to generation without anyone questioning. So what are the regrets that you feel? Generally speaking, when you're informed that your time to leave this body, leave this world has come. So we were pointing out, we were discussing Thursday at the Bhakti House. Those of you who are here who attended, you remember that hospice workers have pointed out that before you get to the regret stage, there's first the cycle of denial. No, it can't be true. It can't be true that I have to leave this body. No. These things don't happen to me. I'm a good person. Why is it I have to give up my body? So first there's denial. And then there's anger. This is not fair. Why me? If there's a God in control, he's doing a really horrible job. Because I have to give up my body. So there's denial, there's anger, and then fear. Oh, what will become of me? What will my future be? Oh, I have no idea. I was just going with the flow, taking life as it comes, and now life is going. What does that mean for me? I have no idea. Is this going to be sheer terror? Will I just dissolve? So you go from denial to anger to fear and then resignation, acceptance. Well, what will happen will happen. I can't fight it anymore. So I was explaining Thursday at the Bhakti House that reactions can take different forms according to the particular local situation that you're in. For example, the USA is known as, at least abroad, is known as a religious country due to a high percentage of external religious affiliation, nominal religious affiliation. So often when people get the news of death coming, they get angry at God. I've worshipped you. I've sang hymns. I've given donations on Sunday. How is it that I am dying? So they get angry at God. In other countries that are more secular, I spend a lot of time in Australia and New Zealand, where there's very little trace of Christianity left. So there, people don't get angry at God. Why? Because they never think about God. But they still get angry. What do they get angry at? The government. We pay high taxes in these countries for health care, and the government has not fulfilled its pledge to understand all diseases and eliminate them. I'm dying. It's the government's fault. You see, they don't have the controversies in those countries like the UK, Australia, New Zealand that you have here about health care. They think the American thing about health care is crazy. I think everyone should be entitled to health care. So therefore, since everyone's entitled to health care, they blame the government. I'm dying. You failed me. I paid my taxes, and I'm dying. It's the government's fault. So they don't blame God because they don't believe in God. So now let's look at the regrets. We discussed on Thursday the top five regrets. Number one, why did I live my life according to everyone else's expectations? Why wasn't I more true to myself? Can you see yourself perhaps having that regret at the end of your life? I lived my whole life based on what others wanted. What about me? It's too late now. I'm at the end. I can't reverse the film. I can't do a rewind. Why wasn't I more true to myself, whoever that self is? Another regret is, why did I simply work so hard? Why didn't I allot my time for other things that are more meaningful? I allowed myself to be locked into a cycle of just work, 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 work. The work consumer cycle. Work, buy, consume, die. Why did I let that happen to me? Now, at the end of life, I have no strength for anything. Work life took it all out of me. What's another regret? Friends. I didn't keep up with my friends. I had good relationships. I had nice friendships. But due to working so hard, due to family complications, divorce, remarriage, this, that, moving here, moving there, you know, compared to the world average, Americans move more than any other people. Just, you know, changing locations constantly. So you leave aside friends again and again. And then when marriages form and split, whole constellations of friends are often lost. So this is a big regret at the time of death. Why didn't I pursue my friends? Why didn't I try to reestablish lost friendships? We were discussing this on Thursday in the context of a movie, a current movie, which has the plot that a meteor is bearing down on the planet Earth, and it's going to obliterate the Earth in a couple of months. Everyone knows it. So this man decides he's going to track down his high school sweetheart and rekindle the relationship. So we were asking those who attended on Thursday, what do you think about that? Do you think that's the way to end things? Do you think that that's a good use of your last moments? So we had a very good discussion about this. So you see, we want everyone to understand that Bhagavad Gita applies to real life. It's not some pie-in-the-sky theoretical metaphysical text. So we like to talk about the bhakti knowledge, the Krishna conscious knowledge, in terms of our everyday context. So one of the main regrets people have when they're informed that their time in this body is up is, my friends, why did I let my friendships slide away? Mm-hmm. Another regret is, I should have acted more for my own happiness. I should have made that the priority, my happiness. Instead, I was living too much for the sake of others, worrying about others being happy. But what about me? I never really focused on me and my happiness. Of course, Bhagavad Gita will inform you that how can you focus on your happiness when you don't know who you are? So these are some of the main regrets that people feel, based on not knowing what to do with the life now. That means we don't know what to do with the life, with our life, when we're alerted that it's time to leave this world. So this is very risky living. And Bhagavad Gita is trying to correct that extraordinary risk of living a life in which we don't know what we're doing or why. So what Krishna is explaining to Arjuna in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, text 2, is evam parampara praptam imam rajasyo vidu. We'll do this first half of this verse. This supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. Now, the important immediate impact of this text from antiquity is that Bhagavad Gita is not just food for speculation, interpretation, spiritual, poetic creativity. Bhagavad Gita is actually meant as a guidebook for governments. Now, sometimes people become afraid of that. Oh, are you talking about a theocracy? You're talking about religious fanaticism dominating the government. No, Bhagavad Gita is not talking about that. Bhagavad Gita is presenting information, essential information for any sane government leader of whatever calling, of whatever ethnicity, of whatever nationality, of whatever sectarian consideration. Bhagavad Gita is beyond sectarian consideration. Now, how could that be so? You might think, well, isn't Bhagavad Gita a Hindu book? Or isn't Bhagavad Gita an Eastern classic? Well, is the sun an Eastern classic? Although the sun rises in the east, is it an Eastern classic? Bhagavad Gita presents essential information for every living entity, no matter what your material body is. What is the proof? In the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna is in crisis and Krishna has to bail him out. Krishna is the best one for bailing someone out of crises. So, what's the first thing that Krishna says to Arjuna? The first instruction he gives to rectify Arjuna's crisis. Krishna gives the non-sectarian principle that the body is changing from childhood to youth to adulthood to old age. The body is also changing at death. But the real person, known in Sanskrit as the Atma, the spirit soul, that doesn't change, although the body is changing. The body goes through so many phases, just like new clothes become worn clothes, become old clothes, become tatters. But the person who wears the clothes, relatively speaking, in a limited way, that person goes on, although the clothes are finished. So similarly, Krishna points out that it doesn't matter whether you call yourself a Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Jewish, whatever. It doesn't matter whether you call yourself a Democrat, Republican, Independent. It doesn't matter whether you voted or you didn't vote. It doesn't matter whether you're American, Russian, Canadian, this, that. It doesn't matter what color you are, brown, blue, polka dot. It doesn't matter. What is it about you that doesn't change when the body changes? This is non-sectarian knowledge. Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna say, it's only for the Hindus, this knowledge about the soul changing bodies. He doesn't say that in Bhagavad Gita. Or it's only for the Catholics. Or only the Canadians should believe this, not the Americans. It doesn't say that. Krishna is speaking universal truth, non-sectarian truth, that there's something about you, no matter what label you put on yourself, there's something about the real you that doesn't change although the body is changing. So this is why Bhagavad Gita is invaluable for the leaders of society. They need to know what is the nature of the creatures they're dealing with. Otherwise, so many great mistakes are made when we don't understand what our identity is. If we don't understand who we are, then how can we understand how to benefit ourselves? So what you see in the world today is a problem with governments in that they don't know what the nature of the people is. They don't know the nature of their constituency. Because of lack of clear non-sectarian knowledge, am I the body or not? So if the government leaders are bewildered about that, the people are bewildered. And because the people are bewildered, they elect bewildered government leaders. This is the point Bhagavad Gita is making. It's not about Hinduism, Christianity, this ism, that ism, this nationality, that nationality. It's all about, do you understand what is it about you that doesn't change although the body's changing? So never in Bhagavad Gita does Krishna ask you, by the way, what religion are you? By the way, what nationality are you? Nowhere. Krishna is speaking universal truth, and he's saying in this verse, text 2 of chapter 4, that this supreme science comes down through the chain of masters and students, known in Sanskrit as parampara. And that's how the leaders, the executive heads of society, received it. The executive heads of society, in the days when the ancient yoga culture was prevalent in India, the executive heads of state received knowledge from the gurus about how to benefit the people. And in that way, the people could actually be protected. Not simply protected against aggression, that would be a good start, but being protected against the attackers of high consciousness. You see, we have a mind that gets us into so much trouble. Our mind is accompanied by unwanted guests. These are described as lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, and illusion. These six unwanted guests are always hanging out in your mind. And that's why you do things that you later regret, or even if you don't regret them later, you're going to feel karmic reactions because of these things. So how to deal with these unwanted riders? A deep-thinking human being is concerned about that. As Arjuna asks Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, that what is it that makes me commit bad karma acts, even against my own will? So Krishna explains to him that you've got some unwanted guests associated with the mind, and they drag you around. Let's consider how our mind is dragging us around. If we've grown up in a typical lifestyle of no spiritual discipline, no training in how we are different from the body and the mind, then we're going to be subject to the mind, and that means being subject to these riders that are there with the mind. We'll be subject to lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, and illusion. How can we ever be peaceful? Because birth after birth, lifetime after lifetime, these riders are hanging on to our mind. In other words, as we move from one lifetime to another, we're not just going through some innocent process of reincarnation. Reincarnation is not such a giddy thing, you know. It's got ramifications. So one of the ramifications of changing bodies is that you accumulate trash that you bring from one lifetime to another. You all know persons who, they just collect too much in their house. They just never throw anything away. Often, until it's time for you to move houses, you never realize how much junk you have. So, from going from one lifetime to another, we accumulate trash in our mind. And so, the longer we spend in material existence, revolving from one body to another, the more trash is there that has to be eliminated. But what is the process for eliminating trash? How is it that we are separate from our mind and body? If we don't understand that, we won't know how to deal with all the trash we've accumulated. In fact, we'll take all that accumulated trash as, well, that's just me, you know? You know, me and my trash, you know? Haven't you told someone, look, you know, you got to love me the way I am. That means you got to accept my trash. That's me. Of course, in contemporary India, no one says like that, you know. give them 5 or 10 years. But it's common in the Western world that you insist, look, you know, this is the way I am, you know, trash and all. If you want to be with me, this is, you know, you got to love me for what I am, you know. And you want to see how the person actually loves your trash. And then you know it's a deep relationship, right? Yeah, this is stuff. You actually tell others, you know, you're happy about it. You know, he really loves me, you know, with all my craziness. That's supposed to be the sign of a deep relationship. Now, Bhagavad Gita goes much deeper than this. It takes very seriously the human condition in a non-sectarian way. That's why it's meant for the heads of state. Without knowledge of what the self is and what is the supreme self, how are we actually going to make good decisions? So what you're seeing today, when you look at politics, is not really an institutional crisis. You're looking at a crisis in human beings. It's human beings that have created the institutions. Now the problems affecting humanity are so complex, are so interlocked, people are wondering, do we have the institutions to be able to cope with that? Climate change is so interdisciplinary, covers so many categories, there's things about it that you can't change, some things about it you can change, things you should do now, things you should do in the future, there's reactions coming from it that are already hitting us, reactions that we're not sure whether they'll hit us, it's such a complex issue. Economic factors, political factors, so many factors. So people are wondering, do we have the institutions capable of dealing with human problems today? People wonder, you know, what's going on in Washington, D.C., the fiscal cliff, can the government get it together? Are they too busy just considering their own positions or considering sectarian party sectarianism, what to do? What's wrong with our institutions? What Bhagavad Gita is pointing out is that the institutions are the product of human beings. Because the human beings have problems, the institutions have problems. So therefore, let's deal with the ground level, the root, and reform the human beings. How to control the mind and purify it. That's just the preliminary lesson of Bhagavad Gita. If we don't know that we are spirit soul, part of the supreme soul, and that real pleasure comes from connecting to the supreme soul, to Krishna, we'll manufacture such an artificial way of life and then wonder, why are so many problems? Why don't our institutions solve the problems? When the real cause of the whole mess is an artificial understanding of who we are and what the purpose of life is. Because we lack that understanding, we create such a complex web of entanglement. Climate problems, economic problems, gun control problems, this, that, on and on and on it goes. We don't know what the mission of human life is. Just consider, in a couple of states, marijuana was legalized. Colorado, Washington. I've been informed that here in California, it's more or less the recreational use of marijuana is more or less legalized in that, you know, you won't get into very much trouble by possessing a small amount. So the idea is that, look, what's wrong with people getting intoxicated? Everyone needs relief from thinking about life. Everyone needs to escape reality. Just getting wasted. Actually, people become proud about it. I was so blind last weekend. I didn't know, have a clue what was going on. It's like a badge of honor. People can't imagine living without intoxication of some form. If not marijuana, then alcohol. Generally, our Indian families, they don't witness marijuana smoking. But alcohol, they know it's coming in. So the whole point of intoxication is to forget. But this goes against the actual purpose of human life, which is to be fully conscious of who you are, why you're in this world, and make a solution to your existence in this world, a spiritual solution. So that's why in our Krishna conscious society, we easily deal with intoxication. We say no. We are bewildered enough just by taking birth in this body. We don't need any more bewilderment. What to speak of paying for more bewilderment. But the argument, the counter-argument, we have to be fair, we have to present the other side. What do you think? What is wrong with recreational bewilderment? A little blissful forgetfulness. What's wrong with that? And by criminalizing marijuana, you force a huge segment of the population into criminal consciousness. And that's not right, because everyone's doing it anyway. So if you make a law criminalizing marijuana, so many innocent people will be branded as criminals. And because that happens, the people will then start considering real crimes to do, because you've already forced them into the criminal category, you see. Now, if you legalize marijuana, suddenly the people realize, I'm not a criminal anymore, and therefore they don't risk doing other crimes, you see. So, therefore, you do a great favor for the people by relieving this psychological burden of thinking that they're criminal when they smoke marijuana. Because after all, what's wrong with just getting high? What's wrong with just bewildering yourself and forgetting all your problems? Because there's no solution anyway to life's problems, so you might as well just become intoxicated. So by legalizing drug use, we thereby free people from guilt and shame. We stop pushing them towards criminal life because of their partaking of marijuana. They think, oh, now I'm a criminal, so I might as well do more criminal activities. So you take that away. And furthermore, we were explaining this Friday night at a home program that we had nearby here. In New York State, some people are now proposing, yes, we should legalize it in New York. Here's the reason why. Because the demand for marijuana is so great. If we legalize it, there can be so much employment because of people needing to grow marijuana. It'll create so many jobs, and that's what it's all about. Not only will it create so many jobs, but one, you can tax it, and that tax money will save the school system. So why not? Now, it actually, on a certain level, this makes sense if you don't know what the goal of human life is. It all makes sense. But if you know what is the goal of human life, what human beings should be doing with their consciousness, then, of course, the situation is tragic. Why should a government that knows what is the purpose of human life allow human beings to obliterate themselves, to waste themselves, to become unconscious and think that that's pleasure? Real pleasure means to fully maximize your consciousness in association with the Supreme Consciousness. Another term for Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Pleasure. So why become forgetful of this ultimate reality when the ultimate reality is the supreme pleasure? So a bhakti yogi, a Krishna conscious practitioner, doesn't want intoxication, doesn't want to forget. He or she wants to be more awake, more conscious. Because when we're more awake, we're more conscious, that means we're more aware of the supreme consciousness and our relation with the supreme consciousness. So that is bhakti. That is the science of Krishna consciousness. So if we understand what is the goal and the mission of human life. Then we can actually lead a society. And when there are government leaders that can lead a society moving toward enlightenment, those government leaders get credit from the people's activities of enlightenment. And the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, explains that for government leaders who do not take steps to encourage people, to guide people, to maximize their enlightenment, and instead the people do bad karmic activities, such as intoxication, animal slaughter, gambling, so on, those government leaders get 1/6 of the karmic reaction of every citizen in their domain, in addition to their own karmic reactions. Now just think about that. How many millions of people live in the USA? 300 million? So that means you're in charge of the USA. You've got to deal with your own karmic reactions. And then you get 1/6 of every one of the 300 million people in your land. 1/6 of their bad karma. The reverse is also true. If the people in your land are doing good karma, the government leader gets 1/6 of all their good karma. So this is Krishna's incentive system. Not just negative, but positive. It's a very serious thing to take responsibility, not simply as a government leader, but even as a mother, as a father, as a teacher. Any kind of responsible position you take has these stipulations that you get a reaction if you don't fulfill your responsibility properly. So therefore, in the Vedic system of the ancient yoga culture, the executive heads were responsible for arranging a society in which persons could maximize the goal of human life, achieve the mission of human life, and not go backwards. And these executive heads were guided by spiritual preceptors. In this way, the whole society could be progressive. The spiritual preceptors, were not like dogmatic and just saying, you must believe this, you must believe that. They could present the comprehensive science of the soul. There's a big difference between being spiritually autocratic. Everyone in this nation should believe this religion. No, that's not what Krishna is talking about in Bhagavad Gita. What Krishna is talking about in Bhagavad Gita is that everyone should know the science of the soul and the Supreme Soul. And they should understand you can verify this science in the laboratory. And here's how you do it. Isn't that fair? Nowhere in Bhagavad Gita is Krishna saying you should shove Bhagavad Gita down everyone's throat and they should say, I believe. It's nowhere there. Krishna himself, verse after verse, chapter after chapter in Bhagavad Gita, is explaining that you can verify what I'm saying. I want you to verify it. Here's how you do it. Here's the methodology. So what more do we want? So that is why Bhagavad Gita is tailor-made for the executive heads of state. It gives them the knowledge that they need in order to actually benefit the people. So therefore Krishna is saying, this supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciple succession, and the saintly kings understood it in that way. Krishna is clearly letting us know, Bhagavad Gita is not just a toy for interpretation, speculation, metaphysical theories. Bhagavad Gita is very straightforward. The Sanskrit is very simple and clear. Bhagavad Gita is actually meant for governments to apply so that their peoples are truly benefited, so that the people are protected from the wildness of the mind and its riders, lust, anger, greed, madness, envy, illusion. Birth after birth, those riders are there with you. And so the trash of so many lifetimes accumulates in our mind. It's impossible materially to deal with all that. But the preliminary effect of Bhagavad Gita and Bhakti Yoga is indeed to cleanse the mind of all that trash so that indeed you can see your spiritual identity as spirit soul, part of Krishna, the Supreme Soul. All right. Are there any questions? Yes. Everything is possible because Krishna is the supreme controller. Anyone who knows actually what is God will agree that Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead. But you actually have to know what is the science of God. Otherwise, you'll think that's just a sectarian statement. You say it's Krishna. Others say it's that. But if you actually know the science of what is God, you'll easily accept Krishna. So the problem is not sectarianism. The problem is lack of understanding the science of God. People think, oh, you know, it's whatever, you know. Some people say Krishna. Some people say that, you know. It's whatever you want, you know, whatever, you know. But in Bhagavad Gita, you are taught how to understand what is the Supreme Absolute Truth in a non-dogmatic way. In a way that can be verified by you in your lifestyle. So, isn't that fair? So, we're taking as our service to Krishna to try to make everyone aware of the extraordinary benefit of applying Bhagavad Gita in human society. That's the work that Krishna wants done. That is Krishna's mission when he comes to this world. So we are Krishna's tiny servants, and we will assist Krishna in that great task. We'll do our best, and certainly, just see, 40 years ago, 50 years ago in the world, no one outside of India knew anything about Krishna. Now everyone knows something about Krishna. Right or wrong, still they know something. In my, last year at university, I wanted to understand something about Bhagavad Gita. So I signed up for a course taught by a world-famous professor in Hinduism. And she's still world-famous. And so I went to the course, and he was asking the students, you please read some of the Vedas, and your first assignment is to write an essay about what you think it means. So I thought, wait a minute, what do I know? I came to this class to get knowledge, and now I'm being told simply to speculate. I don't need to come to class in order to speculate. I could do that with my friends 2 a.m. in the morning. So I decided to go to the university bookstore at Yale and get all the books recommended for the course, and I would drop the course. I just studied on my own. So I went, and Bhagavad Gita was on the course list. So I got a Bhagavad Gita. It was a translation and commentary by a British person, British scholar. So I remember I took it into my room and I opened it up. Oh, this is Bhagavad Gita, the classic yoga text. Oh, I should read this. And so I just flipped through it and I opened, and he had his commentary. And I just read one sentence. Krishna is a concept meant to satisfy both the intellectuals and the sentimentalists. Something in me just told me, slam the book shut, throw it against the wall. That's what I did. That's what I did. Never opened it since then. And then upon graduation, I came across Bhagavad Gita as it is. And then I knew my real education had begun. So, just think, 50 years ago, no one knew the slightest thing about Krishna. Now, all over the world, the most remote places, people know something about Krishna. Well, certainly, in time, some fortunate heads of state will take Bhagavad Gita seriously. Yes. Okay. Yes. So he wants to know about the garbage removal. That's why we have the Hare Krishna mantra. That's the preliminary effect of chanting Hare Krishna. It cleanses the consciousness from trash accumulated for countless lifetimes. So the more seriously you take the chanting of Hare Krishna, the more the garbage is removed and you can start to see who you really are. And then automatically, so many other problems are solved. Your ecological footprint, your greed, your consumerism. So many things are solved simply by learning how to relish the spiritual pleasure in association with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Pleasure. You don't put so many demands on other people's bodies and minds. You don't put so many demands on the earth. Everything goes better by chanting Hare Krishna. And, of course, the real effect of chanting Hare Krishna is that you revive your dormant relationship with Krishna in pure love. Anything else? Yes. Yes. A perfect moment in bhakti yoga, Krishna consciousness, is when you're thinking, how can I give pleasure to Krishna? Because everything is Krishna's energy. How can I use everything around me and myself included for Krishna's pleasure? That's a perfect moment. Another one. All right. If what about impersonalism? What did you say about impersonalism? If we were free from impersonalism, which is a form of denying Krishna's existence, because we want to be the person that exists. So Krishna is actually just a vague whatever, you know, but my life, well, that's really specific. So when we free ourselves from that kind of impersonalism, of denying that the supreme ultimate cause of causes, all causes, has qualities, activities, form. When we free ourselves from denying that, then we see ourselves as the servant of the supreme absolute truth. We are tiny. We're not the masters. We are the tiny servants, the parts. And so we'll see ourselves as Krishna's eternal servants, and we'll seek to engage everything around us and in us for the service of Krishna. Without that, what do? We try to be masters of the material world, and we end up serving matter. Just try to analyze throughout the whole day how much service we're doing to our body, to our mind, to our employer, to our government, to our, things like desire for prestige, respectability, for more money, for sensuality. Service, service, service. But when Krishna says, "You are my eternal servants," impersonalism is a concoction that says, well, we're all masters, Krishna and us. We are all it. It is all us. It's a tricky way around just saying there's no supreme absolute truth. Instead of saying there's no supreme absolute truth, you say, we are all it. We are all the supreme. That's a tricky way of saying there's no supreme. Chanting Hare Krishna cleanses that illusion, and then we see our real subordinate position. What's wrong with being subordinate if you have a good parent? How many of you, if you had good parents, when you were 4 or 5 years old and you had good parents, were in anxiety? Is the mortgage being paid? Am I going to eat next week? No. If we have any little kids here, you can see how secure they feel with a good parent. The kid's not hung up about being subordinate. That happens when you become a teenager. But otherwise, when you're a little kid, you're happy to be subordinate, right? Where's mommy? Where's daddy? And you see how the little kids climb on the parent's lap and just love to be subordinate. That's our natural state with Krishna. So the more we understand Krishna, the more we'll allow ourselves in full knowledge to be dependent on Krishna. But when we don't know anything about Krishna, then we got a lot of paranoia. What is this talk about being subordinate on Krishna? We're just as good as him. If he wants to be supreme, we're also the supreme too. We won't let's be fair. We won't deny Krishna's supremacy, and we won't deny our supremacy. But we're all in it together. That's spirituality, California style. So we invite you all to please consider Bhagavad Gita from a different angle of vision, as a non-sectarian universal text meant to give guidance to the heads of state. And that way the people can truly be protected. Protected not with religious dogma or some kind of Taliban principles, but protected with the supreme spiritual science. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.